Hello and good evening and welcome to PA Book Club. It is that time of the month and tonight we are here with Greg Johnson and we are reviewing The Enemy of Europe by Francis Parker Yockey. And I'm really looking forward to tonight's book club because I've got to say I enjoyed the book. And not only did I enjoy the book, but I think it poses some very important questions about modern happenings in the Ukraine. I'm going to get that straight out the way first because we were talking before we came on the show a little bit about that. But we'll deal with the book first. Now, tonight we are live on Odyssey, we're live on DLive, and we're live on Radio Albion. If you would like to support this show, if you'd like to support what we're doing, you can do so by clicking on the Entropy link, which we placed on in the chat throughout the evening. You can send paid super chats or non-paid questions. You can also contribute by clicking on the support button over on Odyssey. Any paid super chat will be read out live on the show, or the questions will be asked to people in the chat on the panel who the question is directed to. We will be doing questions in the second hour of the show. This is a very, very interesting book. So I really do hope people do ask some questions because of all the books that we've read on Book Club, I do think this is one that poses some really, really interesting questions that I've actually discussed with other nationalists in the past. I'm going to talk a bit about that later. So let's get straight into things and we'll start by welcoming Greg Johnson and say hello, Greg. Would you like to introduce the book and would you like to tell us a little bit about what it's about and why you chose to publish it?
Yes, it's a pleasure to be back. Thank you for having me on the show again. I keep putting books out and you keep inviting me on the show. I think it works really, really well. So thank you. A few years ago, just before Yockey's 100th birthday, I thought we really do need to have some kind of well-edited and comprehensive edition of his surviving writings. And so I started work on what's called the Centennial Edition of Francis Parker Yockey's writings. And the first volume that we published came out a few years ago. That is called The World in Flames. That's all of his shorter writings, including the surviving issues of his newsletter, Front Fighter, and some pieces that he seemed to have co-authored with or ghostwritten for other people. And so that's incomplete because history has just devoured a lot of his writings. A lot of his things were lost. A lot of things that were seized by the FBI when he was arrested and were listed as being in his luggage were destroyed years later by the FBI in some kind of paperwork storage reduction effort. It's just appalling that this man's, you know, philosophical and geopolitical writings were just dumped because the federal government wanted to basically save a few feet. You'd think that they could have stuck them somewhere in that warehouse with the Ark of the Covenant and all that stuff. But no. And then the second volume we worked on is The Enemy of Europe. And this is a very interesting project because The Enemy of Europe was destroyed. It was destroyed by the West German puppet government of the United States. It was published in the early days of the Cold War. It argued for Germany looking to the east rather than to the west for its alignment. And the liberal democracy in Germany seized the printing plates and printed copies of the book and destroyed them entirely. And the only thing that survived were a few copies of the German edition of the book. It was published in both English and a German translation. And the English edition has been completely lost, and a few copies of the German edition circulated and survived. And in the late 1960s, somebody started trying to translate the book back from German into English, right, to publish it in the United States. And in the late 70s, eventually an almost complete translation of it was published by a fellow named Thomas Francis at this magazine and publishing imprint called Liberty Bell. And then I was thinking, okay, we're going to need to probably do a new edition of it, a new translation, because I had no idea how to get a hold of the Liberty Bell translation or the rights to it. I didn't even know if it was good. I hadn't compared it with the original. And then the translator, the original translator, Thomas Francis, got in touch with us. He was so pleased about the project that he reached out and said that he wanted to give us a complete edition with all the epigraphs and things like that included. And so he worked on it and And early in 2020, we started working on it. And I reached out to him and I couldn't get back in touch. He never got back in touch. He just disappeared. And I'm wondering if he might have died in the COVID pandemic or something. He must have been getting up there in years. This was after the beginning of COVID and everything. But anyway, I've never heard a peep from him. I basically ended up giving the translation over to Roger Devlin to work on. So this is sort of a collaboration of Thomas Francis, who did the original translation, and F. Roger Devlin, who's a well-known and well-respected guy in our circles. There's an excellent introduction that puts it in its historical context by Kerry Bolton. There are a lot of annotations in the book that I provided and that other scholars provided. And then we also have the German. We have the German original. But instead of publishing the German original as it was published, which was filled with all kinds of mistakes, including obvious translators' mistakes, it was obviously translated into German by a person who was not a native speaker of German. Most likely it was Yaki himself. And so what we decided to do is actually bring out a creditable German translation too. And so we corrected all the mistakes and we annotated them. So if you want, you can figure out what the original text was like, and there are PDFs of it out floating around too. So not only did we bring this book back from the ashes, literally from the ashes, because it was destroyed, we also published it in a creditable German translation as well. We cleaned up the German translation. We restored the English translation to something approaching the original, which was a huge amount of work trying to get Yaki's style right. He was eccentric in his use of capitalized words. I sweated a lot trying to make sure that the words he would definitely capitalize were capitalized. It's lavishly annotated. There are two indexes, one for the English translation, another for the German original. And I'm very proud of it. It also looks really good. I think it is a well-designed and elegant-looking book. And really, it's on the standard of the best academic presses. Oxford University Press, Yale University Press, Cambridge University Press would not have come up with a better edition of Francis Barker Yaki's The Enemy of Europe were they so inclined to publish somebody like Yaki. So it's a project that I'm rather pleased with and I'm rather proud of. And then the final volume in this edition will be Imperium. And that will be published at the end of next year. And I'm editing that. That edition will have the original introduction written by Willis Cardo and published with the Noontide Press edition in the early 1960s. And it will be extensively annotated. We have a lot of apparatus, a lot of scholarship that we can bring to bear on this book now, including very careful scholarship showing where he was plagiarizing certain things from Carl Schmitt and other writers that he was echoing in certain ways. All of his citations, his paraphrases and things like that have been annotated. We did that with The Enemy of Europe. There was a scholar who has to remain nameless who contacted me, and he had found the sources for all of these quotations that Yaki had included. And what Yaki would do is he would often write from memory. And so the quotations were paraphrases, usually, sometimes pretty radical paraphrases. And this fellow amazingly tracked down the original sources for all kinds of quotations from Oswald Spengler and from Napoleon. Those are the two major figures. And I was tearing out my hair trying to track these down. And I discovered that there was a scholar who had actually done the work, and he's done the same work for Imperium. So I'm very, very excited about these books. I think Yaki deserves a good edition of his writings. And if more things come to light in archives in the future, if more of his essays come to light, if more of his newsletters come to light, we'll expand the World in Flames volume that includes all of his shorter writings. We're hoping that more letters will come to light in the future. He really was a man of mystery, though. And I'm constantly searching through archives. I hear about somebody who might have known Yaki, whose papers have been deposited with a university somewhere. And I'll try and find out if there's something by Yaki there. I did that years ago at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. The H. Keith Thompson papers were there. And I searched through them all, hoping to find some stuff on Yaki. I found a really useful transcript of an interview, a biographical interview that Thompson gave on Yaki that we published at Countercurrents. But I didn't find any correspondence from Yaki. I found a very good photograph of Yaki that I've still yet to release to the world. And things like that. Willis Cardo's papers, his widow, Elizabeth, has been going through them. And she's given me everything that she's found connected with Yaki. But so far, no actual letters by Yaki. But letters from his daughters, for instance, to Willis Cardo, are in my hands now. So it's an interesting project of trying to basically preserve what we can of this important anti-liberal thinker that the powers that be, both on both sides of the Atlantic, tried to destroy and consign literally to the ashes. They literally destroyed this book. They literally smashed the printing plates, and we brought it back from the flames.
Well, thank you. So now we're going to introduce our two reviewers. We'll start with you, Natty, as you're in the top right-hand corner. I hope you've had a nice weekend, and I hope you enjoyed the book. What were your impressions of it, and what were your initial feelings about it?
Hey, Mark, Sally, Greg, it's good to be here. I've had a nice weekend, less rowing this weekend. It's almost the end of the season, so I've been playing a bit of tennis and catching up on the book. I reread the last paragraph. This book's really interesting. I wasn't really aware of Francis Parker Yaki, and I think it's, as an aside to everything we're going to talk about, I think it's a real shame that a lot of the authors who we've looked at the books of, and authors who have written really interesting books, you never hear about unless you are a dissident or run in our circles, or maybe visit sites that are less regulated, just because those people in charge, or people who want to set the culture for Europe and America and European nations, don't want any of these ideas even thought about. I mean, the book is certainly interesting, and there's things in here I agree with and things I don't agree with, and it's just as an academic exercise, it's interesting to read this and hear what this guy thought, taking into account, of course, that this was written just after the Second World War, although there are parallels and some things map onto the things that are happening today, and I'm sure we're going to talk about them. But it's really interesting, even at an academic level. It's there's a lot in here. And I mean, it's called The Enemy of Europe, although the book itself is split into essays of about 4 or 5 pages each, some of them slightly shorter, some of them slightly longer. But the actual essay, The Enemy of Europe, is on the last 10 or 11 pages. And he builds up, his thesis builds up, and he talks about the collapse of the British Empire. And he's got this very metaphysical idea of what Europe is and how power flows in and out of Europe and how it's happened over the last 100 years, which is really interesting to read. So it's certainly interesting to talk about it tonight with you guys. So, yeah, very interesting book. Looking forward to talking about it.
Okay, and last but certainly not least, Aunt Sally, how are you doing? I hope you had a lovely weekend. What did you think of the book?
Yes, thank you. Hello, everyone. And I had a lovely weekend, yes. I really liked it. I couldn't put it down. Yeah, I found it explosive in places. Very, very interesting book. Most of it I read with my mouth wide open, like, what? You know, it was one of those for me. I'm a boomer, and growing up in the 60s, we weren't taught anything about the war, nothing. And you didn't ask. You didn't ask because you were frightened to ask. That if you did, they'd say, "What, you don't even know about the war? You don't even, you know that." So you just, no one ever spoke about it. It was, you know, and a book like this, it complements Hellstorm for me in a way, in that it, Hellstorm filled in a lot of the gaps mentally for me of what really went on, and this one fills the political gaps or the theory of the whole thing. It fills that gap. The only thing is that because I haven't ever read war books before, Hellstorm being the first one, I have no reference point to measure it by. So I don't know if the information is 100% correct, or so I can't question any of it. There's a few things in there I'm thinking, well, how did they know that? But the fact is, he wrote this in, it was published in 1953, and we're seeing everything he's saying playing out right now. And I said, my mouth was wide open. I'm thinking, like, he more or less knew where it was going to go. He died in 1960 I did Google him, in FBI custody. Apparently he committed suicide. I wonder about that. And it seems that there was so much effort to hide his work or disappear his work. And I wonder if, you know, the same thing happened to him. He just disappeared. I don't know anything. I've never heard of him before. But yeah, I really did like the book, and it's one of those books that I'll never part with, and I want to read it again, take it all in again, because it really was an eye opener for me.
Okay, thank you. Well, I got this book, and it's a book of two halves, literally. There is two versions of the same book in it, and the second half is in German. So obviously when you get this book, it's a very nice piece, and there is the German one that you can refer to. And if you, obviously, if you're bilingual and you speak German, that's fantastic. Obviously, that was no use to me, but I do think it's a really nice touch that's included. I found the book fascinating, and I'll read from the back. Francis Parker Yockey's The Enemy of Europe narrowly escaped total destruction, published in 1953 in West Germany. The Enemy of Europe argued Europeans should regard the United States, not the Soviet Union, as their greater enemy in the Cold War. West Germany's liberal democratic regime banned the book and destroyed every copy that came into its hands. Now, I find this so interesting because Aunt Sally made a really good point. This book is very prophetic, and it seems to predict a lot of the things that are happening now. But it also stated at a time when almost every other, say, if you want to call them right-wing, nationalist, patriotic group, was on the side of America and saw the Soviet Union as the greater enemy. Francis Parker Yockey seemed to understand that although the USSR was very brutal, extremely physically brutal, that the people would emerge from that one day mentally and racially intact. And what I mean by mentally intact, I mean with their moral foundation intact. And when I say racially intact, I mean that they wouldn't have been replaced in the way that we are being replaced now. And seeing this from a post-Cold War perspective, and looking at Eastern Europe, the side of Europe that was behind the Berlin Wall, and seeing that part of the world as still homogenous, still traditional, still moral, still ethnically intact, and then seeing the other side of Europe, the side that was to the west of the Berlin Wall, and seeing it as morally corrupt, throwing away its culture, its traditions, its people replaced. And you have to ask yourself, which regime actually did more to destroy the people living in it? Was it A, the USSR, or was it B, Western liberal democracy? And I think that's not just a very, very interesting point to consider now because of the book and because we're talking about the book, But I also think it's interesting to consider, because some nationalists are supporting the Ukraine against Russia, some are more amenable to the Russian side. And I think if Francis Parker Yockey was here today, he would certainly be supporting the Russian side. And I said this on a show recently, that I believe that the Ukrainian nationalists that are embracing America, wanting to join NATO, and essentially welcoming Western liberal democracy into the Ukraine, will do far more damage to the Ukraine than Russian artillery ever could. Because once you've let that great evil in, once you've let that degenerate system in, there's no getting rid of it. And I think this book is so incredibly interesting, because at the time it went completely against the grain of every other nationalist writer or nationalist leader. So this was sort of contradictory to anything Oswald Mosley would have said at the time, which is very interesting. And yet now, looking in hindsight, I've got to say that Yockey was almost like a clairvoyant. He almost saw what was going to happen, laid it all out before anyone else did. And you look, and he's talking in terms of American imperialism without knowing of what happened in Iraq, what happened in Afghanistan. He didn't know of all the CIA meddling that would take place during the 70s and 80s, because he wasn't here to see any of that. And this was written and published in 1953. But it's, to call it prophetic doesn't really go far enough. So I think there's so many interesting points to discuss. And I probably have to start with the point that I actually discussed with Dr. David Duke at one point, that ultimately, despite the brutality of the USSR, those who lived behind the Iron Curtain did emerge from it. Or that those countries are racially and morally in a better state today than the countries that weren't behind the Iron Curtain. Would anyone like to comment on that? Or Natty, we were talking about that. What's your opinion on this? And then we'll ask Aunt Sally, then we'll throw it to Greg.
So, yeah, I mean, that was, it's interesting, because when you read the book, I mean, obviously we're all quite comfortable and safe at the moment. I read this on my sofa, I've got a cup of coffee in my hand. It's quite easy to say, well, you know, we would have been better off under the boot heel of the Russians, the USSR. Yockey argues that there wouldn't have been this kind of hysterical propagandizing that was going on during the Cold War against Russia. And, you know, if Russia rolled across Europe, we'd all be subjected and enslaved and live these horrible lives. May have been partially true. But you're certainly right in that Yockey theorized that the countries who would have come out of that were Europeans in general. He wasn't talking about specifically Germany or specifically the United Kingdom or Spain or France or any of that. He was saying Europeans in general would have kind of hardened or hardened themselves or become spiritually more aware and more racially and culturally aware of their history and clung on to these things in the kind of hardship of Russian occupation or Russian leadership, Russian rule. I think Solzhenitsyn actually said something similar, in that the camps kind of brought out this spirituality in him, or this kind of this desire to learn and listen and think about himself and who he was and who his people were. So it could be argued the same would have happened to us. Now, interestingly, talking about Solzhenitsyn again, Solzhenitsyn also wrote Gulag Archipelago, in which he describes the most horrific conditions imposed by the USSR on its subjects, in the form of work camps where, you know, millions and millions of people died, were just disappeared and forced into exile and execution. So Yockey's, you've got to look at this writing as a piece of its time. And Yockey was clearly, he was very prescient in what he was predicting would happen to Europe. And you're right, it's reading it now. I've got loads of notes on this, but reading it now, almost everything is saying, you're kind of mapping onto things that are happening today or that have happened over the last 70 years since he put the pen to paper on this. But it would be very hard, I think, to persuade people of this at the time, although it may become that as true as some of the things he says are now, they will become more true as time goes on, unless Europe and Europeans are totally wiped out and scattered and destroyed as we know it. So it's interesting. Yeah, I think you're right on that count, in that Eastern Europe, culturally, spiritually, now fares better than we do.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. And I do want to go delve more into your notes, time permitting. And Sally, what's your thoughts on what we've said? Because obviously Yockey predicted a lot of things, and at the time his predictions were probably deeply unpopular. But looking back, do you think he had it right?
Well, the impression I got was that he was saying that the two enemies, there were two enemies. There was the American enemy in the form of America, and also that Russia was the enemy. And that this is how I interpreted it, so I might have got it all wrong, but that Europe should have been its own entity and fought, you know, the whole of Europe without Russia should have been the entity. And I think he still had hope for that when maybe he was writing it. But Russia, I mean, we don't know where it's going to go with that, because, yeah, they've conserved their people. But I do wonder where all that's going. Yeah, I'm not keeping up with the news and the war in Russia with the Ukraine. I really don't know. But, the way I took it was that there was two enemies, and Europe was the third. We're the ones that are being destroyed. Europe's being destroyed. The other two have all the power.
Thank you. Greg, what do you think to what we've said? And what do you think to really Yockey's position that ultimately the people behind the Iron Curtain would emerge better off and the USSR would end up being the lesser of two evils, and the American imperialist, what he calls it, he basically states that America was completely controlled by Jewish interests by this point, just as the USSR was. But he claims that America would do more damage. What's your opinion on this?
Well, I think it's dangerous to praise communism for somehow being a conservative force. And I do think it's kind of a bizarre thesis to maintain on the face of it. I mean, there are many people who want to maintain that thesis, who have argued that point. But on the face of it, I think it's an absurd claim. Communism was radically egalitarian, radically anti-racist, radically irrational in its economic and political structure, enormously destructive of culture and the moral fiber of people, created this pervasive cynicism and lack of trust in whatever country it took over. And yes, in the end, you can say that some of these countries in Eastern Europe especially didn't come out all that badly, but I think you can't really give the credit to communism. You can say that these people endured unimaginable oppression and came out with their identities somewhat intact, even though they lost many millions of their people, including a lot of the best of their people. It was by no, you know, good intentions that these countries emerged from the prison house of nations with some shred of their identity. So I think it's a sort of an absurd thesis on the face of it to put that out there. And it frankly shocks people in the East when Westerners put forward this kind of thesis. One thing that I will say that strikes me as correct about this book, though, is that Yockey talks about the German Michelle, or Michael. And this is a sort of an image from the 19th century of basically a politically inert, selfish, self-absorbed, self-indulgent, essentially bourgeois or sub-bourgeois kind of German. the German consumer, the German liberal, the German with no real roots or anything like that. And he said that the worst thing about the Western domination, American domination of Europe, is that America promotes this class of people, because that's really the American type. The American type, America is a bourgeois society from top to bottom. We're all about comfort, security, long life, avoiding risks and things like that. There is that stratum in Europe. That stratum was promoted heavily by American occupiers. Whereas there are some writers that I've actually published at Countercurrents who talked about how post-communist Eastern European countries are more healthy because that element was destroyed in their societies. Basically, the bourgeois element was destroyed. And in most of these societies, the middle classes weren't even, say, ethnically Polish or ethnically Romanian. They were Germans and Jews for the most part. And when the Germans swept in, the Jews were swept out. And when the communists swept in, the Germans left. And these countries were left without a stratum that was basically receptive to the worst sorts of bourgeois liberal individualism, American style. I do think that that is something that he's correct about. It is a consequence of the war. It's a consequence of the Third Reich sweeping the Jews out and the Russians sweeping the Germans out of Central and Eastern Europe. But again, can you really praise them for what they've done? You know, it's an unintended consequence of war, basically. So my sense is that it's a dangerous thesis to maintain. There is some basis for it in Yaki's book that matches up with things that certain post-communist Polish writers that we've cited at Countercurrents have pointed out about what Yaki calls the German Michel, what these writers would call sort of the usually foreign German and Jewish middle classes in these Eastern European countries, which were destroyed basically by communism and before them by the Germans, by the war and the occupation, etc. So anyway, the thesis that the Russians get a pat on the back for somehow preserving certain aspects of Eastern European identity is equivalent to the people, and there are people who write books on this, who say that Christianity deserves a pat on the back for maintaining the legacy of the pre-Christian world. Whereas if you actually look at what happened with Christianity and the pre-Christian world, most of the pre-Christian world's literature and philosophy and so forth was destroyed by Christianity. And the art was destroyed and vandalized by Christianity. And the few scraps of stuff that was not destroyed, we're supposed to praise them for keeping around. The same thing is said by the apologists for Islamic civilization. We're told, oh, we must bow down and thank Islam, thank them for preserving ancient Greek wisdom. Well, it was really no intention of their own. It's just that they got tired burning books after a certain while. They couldn't feed all the books into furnaces to heat bathhouses and stuff like that. And so some stuff got left over, right? So I think that it's a dangerous thesis, and I don't think it's a completely correct thesis, but there's a shred of truth to it. And I'll hand it over to you.
I think you set up a bit of a straw man there, Greg. And the reason I say that is because I think Aunt Sally hit the nail on the head. I don't think Yaki is saying that the Russians or communism was wonderful and that we should be hailing it. But I do think that Yaki made the very, very important point that, or predicted effectively, that what we would end up seeing is that when, and I think he realized that communism wasn't going to be something that lasted forever, but I think he realized that it would end up being the lesser of two evils. And I think history has proved him correct, because you do look at what happened in Eastern Europe. It was sickening. It was terrible. What communism did was anti-white. It was against all of those people as individual peoples, but they still emerged from it as individual peoples, and they emerged from it with their morality intact. Whereas if you look at where America has gone with what it has pushed through its vast imperialist network, that seems to have done more damage to the ethnic makeup of our people in the long term, but also to our moral nature. So when people, if you go to Eastern Europe, it is still the social norm to be a traditional heterosexual family and have children. It is, these countries are not suffering from the kind of horrors that we're seeing here in the West with the weaponized degeneracy. And whereas, and that's not to say that communism is a force for the good of our people, but it is saying it's the lesser of two evils. And I think that Yockey correctly argued that Europe should, I think it was Anne Sy that said this, that Europe should be seen as a third player in this game, and that ultimately they should be under their own steam, move in their own direction, and have their own will to power, their own self-determination, because that would lead to, you know, a flourishing of the European people. And something else I found so very interesting in the book was when he talks about the Second World War, he sets up this situation where he said Russia were only allowed to advance as far as they did because of American help. And basically, America and Russia between them carved up Europe under two different sort of dynasties of Jewish power, one being the Bolshevik communist Jews and the other being the Western liberal democratic branch, which push all kinds of different horrors. And as I said, and I can't stress this enough, Britain has been a massive victim, probably the largest victim other than America, of this Western liberal democracy. And I would wager this, and I'd like, obviously I want to give Greg a chance to respond to this, but I want Natty and Aunt Sally to just give their perspective on this. Here in Britain, we've seen in excess of 100,000 white girls sort of systematically groomed, sexually assaulted, raped, trafficked, even murdered by men who are of migrant descent. Now, I think I'm right in saying that something like that would not happen in Poland, or in Latvia, or in Hungary. But it happens in the West. And we're still, as a people, largely calling such a thing enrichment. And I would say that the sickness that has been driven into our minds by Western liberal democracy has left us worse off than the mindset of the average Pole, or the average Hungarian, or the average Latvian. And that doesn't mean they didn't suffer in a different way, but those that emerged from the suffering are mentally and ethnically better off. And that's not to write off all the monstrous evils of communism, because you could never do that. But I think what Yockey is doing is looking at it from a very cold and pragmatic point of view. And this is something else I want to transition to in a moment, is that Yockey talks in his book, and he is cold and pragmatic in some ways, but he argues in the book that that is the nature of a man, that a man views things in that cold and pragmatic way, that a man looks at the world and says, well, yes, Russia was awful. Yes, the USSR was awful, but the people that emerged on the other side were better off. And that's the pragmatic view. Whereas the view taken by Americans, he says, is always based on emotion, on a matriarchal viewpoint where everyone acts as mother hen and cries big tears over everything and can't look at things in a pragmatic point of view. And I think he backs up what he's saying so excellently there as well. Natty, would you like to comment on any of that? Or, you know, and obviously feel free to jump in on the matriarchal part too.
So definitely what you've just said about his description of the American spiritual side of things, where he's saying that he kind of describes American as hyper individualistic, unable to sacrifice for the larger good. And when he was talking about this kind of stuff, I was thinking about the ancestors of this country who would start building a cathedral knowing that they would never see it completed, and guys who maybe went off to conquer various lands for the empire, knowing that they would probably die, but willing to do it because they had this internal belief in something bigger than themselves. I'm not saying that's either a good or bad thing, but he does seem to have this disdain for the American soul, and he says it's kind of detached, not only geographically, but culturally and through time and spirituality, is detached from the kind of soul of the European man, who he counts as kind of one people. He doesn't seem to distinguish between the nations of Europe. But he also has this equal disdain for Russians. I mean, he describes them as barbarians and kind of people unable to create an empire in the same way that Germany did, or in the same way that Great Britain did. Coming back to, so just to close that off, Yockey does, he doesn't seem to like the American people, and he doesn't seem to like the Russian people very much. Now, to come back to what Greg was saying, maybe I'm missing something in the book here and I didn't pick up on it, but I don't think he was venerating communism. He does seem to venerate socialism, and he kind of alludes to the fact that European...
Just a small there. I think he venerates a certain style of socialism in Germany, and he rebrands it ethical socialism.
That's right. Yeah, correct. Yeah. So, and he saw that as the kind of the political and spiritual basis of the German Empire, or in the future the European Empire project that was going to stride out and conquer the world in the same way that Great Britain did. I think what he was arguing was that Europeans would have borne up better under the oppression, under the kind of open, brutish oppression of the Soviet Union, rather than this kind of shadowy, subversive oppression of the United States, or the United States under its current leadership. I think that's as succinctly as I could put it, really.
Before I pass it over, I was just going to say, I do think that's an important point that Natty made. The question here is an enemy that is open and almost upfront about its hostility toward you more or less dangerous than a subversive foe who pretends to be your friend? And I think that's very important. Yockey sort of suggests that America is this subversive force that comes as a friend and destroys you from within, whereas Russia was a very open, barbaric enemy, which is easier to withstand because you know where you stand with that. I'm just going to give Aunt Sally Hersey, then Greg, obviously you've got a full however long you need. Well, not 2 hours or anything, but obviously give your point on this. And Sally, what's your thoughts on this? And did you have any particular take on the matriarchal point that he raises?
Not so much that. I mean, I can see, I agree with what Natty said. That's the thing. But what I wonder is, like, is this a long game? You know, it's still happening. We can see it happening. Called the book for him, it was about two powers, the American and Jewry, and the Russian. It was about the two powers, and the third power was Europe, which was destroyed, really. But it's still happening. The dynamics of it are still going on now. And that's what I just wonder, is it a long game? Because it seems to me that if the goal, the original goal, was to destroy Europe, then it's succeeding.
Greg?
Yeah, well, Yockey saw the Russians as a non-European people, as a barbaric people. He sort of laid that on the table. That was one of his assumptions. and he's trying to persuade Germans in the early Cold War period that still they have nothing to fear from them. If they were to not ally themselves or embrace the United States very closely, that, you know, in the worst case scenario, the worst case scenario is if the Russians had swept over all of Europe, he thought that the Europeans would unite and throw them out and then sort of find their identity again, or they would transform the Russians somehow because they're a superior civilization and the Russians would end up sort of adopting things from Europe, Europeanizing themselves, sort of like the way that Peter the Great did. But in the end, that Europe would be preserved and strengthened by this sort of trial. And that's sort of the worst case scenario, right? If Russia had swept over all of Europe, he's trying to convince patriotic Germans that it would actually be okay. The outcome would be the strengthening of Europe and somehow the strengthening of European character and Europe seizing control of its destiny. It's interesting, though, he didn't seem to think that Europe was up to the spiritual challenge of Western domination. He didn't think that Europe was up to the spiritual challenge of liberal democracy. He thought that the liberal democracy in Europe would not produce a European reaction that would thrust liberal democracy from its shores or transform liberal democracy into something that's acceptable to Europe. And I think that's very interesting. He's trying to convince Germans that they could overcome communism in the worst case scenario, but he doesn't seem to think that Europe could overcome liberal democracy. If it stayed under the sway of American-style liberal democracy, I think that Western European nationalist parties and movements and groups like Patriotic Alternative have to ask themselves, you know, are you able to thrust back liberal democracy and recover your European identity and can seize control of your destiny as a people in the United Kingdom or in France or in Italy? He didn't seem to think that that was possible. He didn't seem to think that the European spirit was up to the challenge of thrusting out liberal democracy, which is an interesting thing.
But why do you think he says that? Because I can answer that, let us know why
it seems to be an assumption of his analysis, right? He thinks that
No, it's not just an assumption, though, is it? I mean, look, Greg, I don't want to get this into I do want to debate you, actually, fully at some point on Ukraine and Russia. I'd love to actually have a formal debate with you on that. But on this, what do you think? Because it seems very clear. I mean, you're the editor of the book, and I do find it strange that you don't seem to see this as clearly as I feel I see it. I think he's saying that a subversive foe that comes to you as a friend and gives you a series of poison chalices, which all look like the greatest thing ever to ingest, is a greater foe or a more dangerous foe. Because everything that Western liberal democracy has given us, it's given us materialism, it's given us unfettered hedonism, it's given this selfish individualism, which has destroyed the fabric of our society. And then at the same time, it has injected huge numbers of migrants into our society, which has slowly started to take over. And we're being replaced because we don't have children because of the materialism, the hedonism, the selfish individualism. But all the things that what he calls Judeo-America or Judeo-America gave to us, they're things that you are drawn to ingesting, but ultimately they poison you. Whereas Russia is like that barbarian. It stands in front of you with the club and says, do as I say or I bash you with club. So people are like, gosh, barbarian is bad. Barbarian is the enemy. Stay back. Whereas with America, people have embraced the poison, the evil, the madness, because it looks alluring. earn more money, take that extra foreign holiday. You don't need to have a child because you can go out and sleep with a different woman every week and it won't matter. You'll be young forever. And who wants a child anyway? You'll have more money for a third foreign holiday. And it's all very alluring, but it's leading you down a path to your destruction. And I think Yoki sort of understood that just so well before any of us understood that. Don't you see that? I mean, obviously you are American, so I don't, some people find it difficult to criticize their own sort of country, but don't you see America as this hugely subversive force that people welcome in, but it ultimately poisons whatever nation welcomes it in?
Well, yes and no. I think I've sort of laid out my understanding of why I think America is what's wrong with America. America is, you know, basically bourgeois civilization perfected, consumerist civilization perfected, individualism perfected, and it's profoundly destructive of culture and identity, including the culture and identity of Americans. The great question is, do we have the ability to throw that off? Do Europeans have the ability to throw that off, given how seductive it is? He didn't think that Russian communism was terribly seductive. He didn't think that they would have any staying power, but he did think that Western liberalism is far more seductive and has staying power. And honestly, liberalism won, right? It won the Cold War. And yeah, there's some mopping up that's still going on the fringes of the world, but it certainly won out in Europe. And the great question is, do we have it in us to end this end of history scenario that liberal triumphalists were talking about after the fall of communism? That's the great question to my mind.
Can I put something to the rest of the panel here? I don't know if you guys have finished discussing this yet, and I'll break in if I feel the need to, but Yoki talks very, in the writing, he's very authoritative about he's very definite about the Third World War. He talks about World War II and he talks about World War III. Now, at the time, he may have been alluding to the Cold War going hot, but do you guys, Mark, Greg, Sally, do you think that given how the West and how NATO has reacted to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, do you think that his predictions, a la World War III, are coming to fruition in the Ukraine as we speak, and that this idea of Europe becoming free of both America and Russia is possibly the outcome that Greg's kind of talking about here, is Europe throwing off the liberal order. It will be the outcome of what may become World War III. What do you guys think of that?
I, my position on the Russian invasion of the Ukraine is as follows. I think Russia is obviously the world's largest landmass. It's got a huge amount of resources, and Putin is very opposed to much of the globo homo liberal ideology, and he's much better for the Russian people than, say, Biden or Liz Truss are for the American or the British people. That's not to say he's perfect. Just because you say somebody's better for something, you know, eating a yellow stained mushroom is better than eating a death cat mushroom, but both will make you poorly. It's just one's going to kill you and one's just going to leave you with gastroenteritis. You'll get over the former. You don't get over the latter. So that's not to say Putin's perfect. But I think what's happening there is NATO and America have goaded Putin into an invasion. And now they are aggressively supporting a Jewish-dominated Ukrainian regime that has no interest in the Ukrainian people. The Ukrainian people are being used as cannon fodder. It's arming those people with the most advanced weaponry it can. So a huge amount of money is being spent on advanced arms that are being sent overseas. So the arms manufacturers are having a field there. I'm sure many politicians in the West are getting very, very rich from kickbacks, etc. But I'll tell you this, they intend to draw Putin deeper and deeper into a war, which they hope will become his Vietnam, because they want regime change in Russia. And I believe, quite fundamentally, that if there is regime change in Russia, that would be a terrible thing for nationalism. And I also think if America ended up on the world stage, not in any way having serious global opposition, I think Western liberal democracy would speed up times 10 if America was unopposed, and that would speed our demise much, much more quickly. So, but I don't think it's going to lead to World War III. I think what it's going to lead to is, or what the West hopes it leads to, is some kind of, you know, Vietnamese-style meat grinder for Russian troops that leads to widespread regime change and ushers in Western liberal democracy in Russia. What do you think, Greg?
Well, I think that clearly the Biden administration and the EU and NATO are basically betting on regime change happening in Russia. I think that contrary to the debacle in Afghanistan, the United States seems to have had very good intelligence when it's come to Russia. I think that could be more a function of the fact that there are just more people willing to sell out Putin than there were people willing to sell out the Taliban. I don't think it has anything to do with the virtues of American intelligence collecting. But I do think that they had a pretty good understanding of how weak Russian military is, or has turned out to be. Much to my surprise, I, like most people, thought this would be over very, very quickly. And it turned out, no, that's not the case. The Russian military has underperformed pretty catastrophically. And I think this is why there's going to be a lot more war in Asia because of this. Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan and Azerbaijan and Armenia, because the regional hegemon has been shown to be weak. And I think this is an extremely dangerous situation, because I think that it will embolden the United States to pursue regime change. And I think that they probably were baiting Russia into the war with that hope in mind. I think they had a pretty good bead on the weaknesses of the Putin regime and the Russian military. And they thought that this would be just the kind of thing that could bring them down. I'm afraid that that might be true. I'm afraid that that might be the outcome here, that Putin might be replaced. And even though I strongly dislike him, and I don't think he should have invaded his neighbor, I think that chances are whoever will replace him will be worse. And if he is replaced by somebody worse than him, or even if he's replaced by somebody better than him, the fact is that there will be a long period of instability in that part of the world, as all kinds of frozen conflicts thaw out, as all kinds of badly drawn borders are fought over and things like that. And any one of these little conflicts can blow up into a world war. You know, one minute you're delivering an ultimatum to Serbia, the next minute the whole world's at war. All of these big wars start small. And so I'm very, very worried that the outcome of this could be, well, you can't predict it. You can't predict everything, but you can certainly predict there's going to be more instability in that part of the world. And frankly, I don't want that.
What are your thoughts, Sally?
Well, my thoughts, I'm happy to defer that to the men, because I'm not following this war. I don't listen to the news. It's just what I see here and there on Telegram and other social media. I don't really have an opinion. To me, I just see a load of theatrics going on, and I listen to the men. So I'm listening to you, Mark, and you, Greg, and Natty, and trying to form an opinion from what you say, because I'm just a bystander as far as this war and theatrics are going on, and I'm just watching it and trying to figure it out still. So I haven't got an opinion. I'm listening to you.
Okay. Well, look, let's do some super chats. And I will say this. I did want to sort of, it's been a great chat so far. I've really enjoyed tonight. I always like talking to Greg. And I did want to sort of speak a little bit about the Ukraine, because I think that as I read this, and I think Natty said this to me as well, he had this in his notes. As we read through this, I was very much thinking to myself, this is just like what we're seeing with the Ukraine. And I believe that, and I'll be honest, I'm not saying Russia is the perfect ruling force for the Ukraine, but I think the Ukraine would be better off under Putin than it would under Biden. I think if the Ukraine was essentially annexed by Russia, that would be better for the Ukraine than it to be annexed by America. And I find it very strange when nationalists support the Ukraine and the Ukrainian regime, because the Ukraine has both a president and a prime minister who are both Jewish. They evacuated all the Jews before the outbreak of the war. They're conscripting every white man they can and sending them into what appears in many ways to be a hopeless situation against the Russians, just with the express intent of killing as many Russians as possible too, and using the Ukrainian whites as basically an expendable resource in order to topple Putin. And I can't see how a nationalist could support that, because to me, this seems just like a NATO ploy to further the American Western liberal democratic reach deeper and deeper into Eastern Europe. But Greg sees this differently. And I've got to say this, I've got a lot of respect for Greg. I really like him. I've met him on a number of occasions. I enjoy his company. And I'm not falling out with Greg. But I would really like at some point to actually debate this with you, Greg, because me and Natty were agreeing with this about the show before the show, and you didn't agree with this. So obviously I want to just give you a couple of minutes before we do the super chats, just for you to counter what I've said. And do you see any parallels between what Yockey was saying then with what is going on now?
Well, no, I don't see the parallels with Yockey. I'll just say this to you. Would you rather that you operate as an ethno-nationalist under the current regime that you're under, or under Vladimir Putin?
Well, that's like saying, would I prefer me running the UK, or would I prefer...
No. Would you prefer being an ethno-nationalist under the current regime in England, or would you prefer being an ethno-nationalist under Russian occupation?
I think I prefer being an ethno-nationalist under Russian occupation. What we're seeing here...
We get our PayPal accounts taken away, and we get our bank accounts taken away.
Putin and we get arrested.
People like us up.
And we get arrested. We get called terrorists. We have a huge amount of oppression at all levels. And
we don't get murdered in prison. Putin basically locks people like us up. I can advocate a homeland for the Russian people in the United States. I've got the freedom to do that. You can advocate a homeland for the Russian people in the UK. If you try and advocate a homeland for the Russian people and the Russian Federation, you go to jail. The kind of nationalism that we stand for is described by Putin as caveman nationalism, and he locks people up for that kind of stuff. And so,
but I know many Russian nationalists who...
Well, I think, just to break in, I think it's slightly skewed. I think probably given that we have certain views, or certainly I have certain views about the Second World War and what really played out there and how it went and how it maybe should have played out, Putin would definitely throw us in jail. Whether you were ethno-nationalist or not.
But that's another issue. But yeah, I know plenty of Russian nationalists, but they all live in Ukraine right now, and they're all fighting on the Ukrainian side. Because Russian ethno-nationalists have been persecuted by the Putin regime, and they found refuge in Ukraine. So I, as a Ukrainian ethno-nationalist, would rather live under a Western-style liberal democracy than under Putin. And in fact, if you look at how Ukrainian ethno-nationalists have performed under their quasi-Western, quasi-liberal democracy, they've done extraordinarily well. They have parties in parliament. They have their own military. Basically, they have bookstores and youth camps and things like that. They're far more successful at advocating for Ukrainian national interests and also talking quite openly about the Jewish problem than comparable parties in the West. And of course, these are the people who are slated for quote unquote denazification by Putin. He is an open enemy of ethno-nationalism in Russia and in neighboring countries. And he's an open enemy of people that I consider to be friends and allies. And so, yeah, I can't be enthusiastic about him at all. I do think that actually ethno-nationalists are better off under liberal democracies for all of their problems than they are under basically a dictatorial regime that's opposed to nationalism and actually has some teeth in their opposition to nationalism that doesn't play by liberal democratic rules, that doesn't even pay lip service to freedom of speech and things like that. I'm 100% for liberal concepts like the right to freedom of speech and things like that, because that's what's keeping us alive in America. That's what's keeping white nationalism alive in America. And it's only by demanding that people in America live up to their professed belief in liberal democratic principles that we have any chance at all at stopping the Great Replacement and turning things around. We would have zero chance if we had basically a civic nationalist, anti-ethno-nationalist regime that was simply illiberal and would basically jail us all for our ideas. And the closest example I can think of to something like that is the way Putin operates in Russia today. So I just think he's the worst possible thing. He's sort of he appeals to Christians, even though he's probably not a Christian. He's sort of socially conservative. He appeals to that. But he's a Christian-branded, vaguely socially conservative, civic nationalist who's authoritarian. And that's the last thing that our countries need. It's the last thing that our countries need because it would appeal to a lot of our constituency who are sort of, they kind of like the strongman types, and they sometimes profess to be Christian and they're socially conservative. But these people in power basically would make the Great Replacement irreversible within the system short of a revolution. And we don't want that. This is why people like Trump, he's an opportunity. But there are a lot of Trumpians who are openly hostile to white nationalist types, ethno-nationalist types. They would create something similar to Putin's regime, which I think would be death to our race in North America. So I'm not a fan of the guy, not a fan of him at all. And I do think that we're better off operating as ethno-nationalists under liberal democracies with whatever remnants of freedom of speech and rule of law and fair play that still exist in these countries than we would under some guy like Putin.
I've got to say, Greg, I completely disagree with you. I mean, when you say the end of your people in America, well, America is rapidly becoming a nation where the descendants of those who founded it are going to be a hated minority. And are literally, you know, you talk about nationalists being persecuted in Russia. Every white is going to be persecuted in Britain and America. The stuff they're pumping out in schools here is so anti-white in its nature. We're not just talking about the persecution of nationalists, but the persecution of anybody who is white British in this country is just, well, it's mind-blowing how quickly that agenda has grown. And I fear as a father for the world that my daughter is growing up in. And I think my daughter would be less hated as a white woman when she grows up in a Russia under someone like Putin than she will be in a Britain under someone like Liz Truss or Keir Starmer. And what's more, I think she would be safer physically in Russia under Putin, definitely, absolutely, than she would be alone in certain British towns or cities under Western liberal democracy. And when you go to places that are free of Western liberal democracy, but were once under the influence of communism, I do see flourishing, beautiful, pro-white nationalistic communities that want to close their borders, that want to go to church, that want to embrace who they are, their ancestors' ways and traditions. When I walk through the cities of countries like France, Britain, I see people who have thrown away every modicum of decency and embraced every form of moral syphilis that has been fed to them. I obviously see this very, very differently to you, but I think America, I think the average white American would be less hated by the Putin regime than they are by the Biden regime.
Is it possible that you two are slightly talking past each other here, and to bring it back to Yockey's thesis, is that a British nationalist, or the Brits themselves, or the Americans, well, maybe not the Americans, because he wasn't talking about them, but European nationalists would be better under a Russian regime, not a Russian-style regime led by our governments, which would obviously be influenced by America and basically be vassal states to America, but under a actual hostile occupation. And to kind of back Mark up a little bit, is that it would make the British people, it would awaken them to their own inherent nationalistic tendencies, their own spiritual side, rather than this kind of, I want to watch Netflix and do nothing and live for the weekend kind of attitude. But to allude to what Greg's saying, the people who would be trying to wake those people up and organize them would certainly be under a much harsher repression and oppression, and most likely, like Greg says, be in jail, if not worse.
Yeah, I think that's fair. That's really what I'm saying. I think that our kinds of people would be worse off in a regime like Putin's than they would be under a Western-style liberal democracy or something approximating that. And I think the future of the white race depends upon our movement. It sounds grandiose to say it, but we're the only ones who are talking about race replacement, demographics, needing to close borders, talking about the Jewish problem, and so forth. We can't solve the problems that we're facing without talking about these things. We're the only people talking about them. We're the only people proposing workable solutions. And it just so happens that we have greater space to maneuver and campaign and organize and persuade people in the West than we would in a country like Russia, where, again, I would be arrested for advocating a homeland for the Russian people in Russia. I'm not being arrested for advocating a homeland for the Russian people from the United States. And for all the crap that I've had to deal with deplatforming and stuff like that, still haven't been gulagged for my beliefs, because we still have some residual liberal democratic tendencies. When I was arrested under false pretenses a few years ago in Norway, there was a great hue and cry about this, and the government within 24 hours basically reversed the arrest. That is something that wouldn't have happened if I'd been arrested and gulagged in the Russian Federation. So I get down on my knees every day and thank God for liberal democracy. I'm putting it in a little exaggerated turn, but seriously, I think we should all thank God, or whatever force we think governs this universe, for the liberal democracies that allow us to advocate for our people's future. Because in countries that don't have that, we have no voice And if we have no voice, then our race has no future.
Can I just say, Natty said exactly what I was thinking. And when I hear Mark and Mark speak, I agree with Mark. And then when I hear Greg speak, I agree with Greg. And that's why I'm happy to defer to the men, because I still can't make up my mind where I stand with all this. But yeah, Natty said exactly what I was thinking.
Well, thank you, sir.
Well, thank you. Let's do some of these super chats. There's still time to donate if you wish to. We've got a few tonight. Glenn the Chinaman gave $3. Thank you so much. And he said, what do you think about Yockey's view that race is spiritual but not biological? I think it's both. If someone looks and acts Chinese but is a quarter or less non-Chinese, I would consider them Chinese. I didn't really get that from the book. I don't think he said it was spiritual. I think he said, I read it as him saying that each race has its own spirit, which is different and distinct. But did anyone else believe that Yockey was?
I've got a
feeling. He doesn't really say that in this book, but he does in Imperium. Yockey believed Spengler's views on race, and Spengler actually believed Boaz, believe it or not. And so there's just a lot of nonsense in Spengler's views on race, and Yockey imports those pretty much wholeheartedly. I think that the only useful concept of race is as a simple biological concept. I think talking about spiritual race and stuff like that, it's obscurantist. It's not a useful thing to talk about. And of course, as soon as you start talking about spiritual race, then the only reason to talk about this is to say, yes, well, he may be half Jewish, but spiritually he's very Aryan. That's like, I don't want to go there, right? I don't want to get into that kind of stuff. I think you can talk about things like character types and so forth, psychology, culture, whatever. But I don't think that race should be understood as a spiritual thing. I think race is a simple biological category. And I think that Yockey really muddies things up in Imperium, basically because he accepts dogmatically Spengler's views, which are just based on nonsense. It's literally based on Boasian anthropology. Boaz argued that people's skulls change when they move to a different environment, and not through natural selection pressures either. So
why does anyone take this crank seriously?
I've just got a vision of someone getting on the ferry from Africa to England. And
his head just changing shape.
Yeah, exactly. I think that Africans, you know, with 100,000 years in a cold climate, you know, they can be changed. They can definitely be changed. But the idea that you take a boat to the New World and suddenly your racial morphology is going to just change because the landscape's different, that's kooky stuff. And it was just put out there as we know it was fraudulent. It was scientific fraud in service of Marxism, which of course basically wants to deconstruct biological race. Why? Because biological race differences get in the way of egalitarian social engineering and social uplift programs. That's why there's all this discussion of social construction. Basically, the left wants to declare anything they want to change a social construct rather than a biologically or naturally fixed category, like the difference between men and women or the difference between black and white.
Okay, we'll go on to the next super chat.
Mark, before you get to it, can I ask Greg, since he brought up Spengler, there's a number of quotes at the start of each of the essays. Sorry, is my mic okay? You guys hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Okay. Were those quotes put in there by Yockey, or were they put in there by you to fit the essays?
Oh no, those are all Yockey's epigraphs. Yeah.
Right. Okay. I wanted to clarify because they fit really well, and I just as I was making notes, I was marking them down, the good ones. It seems he certainly had a good way of using those quotes to kind of underpin the theses he was writing at the time.
Yeah, I wondered that as well.
I've got a number of them written down that I thought were really interesting, but I'm not a Spengler enjoyer, and I haven't read any of Spengler's books, but it seems like a lot of the stuff he's writing is really interesting, and the small quotes, like I said, they very much fit with each of the passages that Yockey's writing. Whether I agree with what Yockey's writing or not, the Spengler quotes go well with it. So he had a, despite, you know, disagreements about Spengler, he obviously understood what Spengler was talking about and used it.
He was hugely influenced by Spengler. Yeah. And the reason why he will quote Spengler and then sound like Spengler is he's very Spenglerian in his basic thinking. He was also influenced by Nietzsche. He's also influenced by Carl Schmitt a lot, but his biggest influence is Spengler. He called Spengler the philosopher.
Right, right. That kind of comes through in the book as well.
Yeah, I could see that he was very influenced by Spengler, but it's kind of strange when you look at sort of Spengler's history that somebody who was obviously so positive towards what he called ethical socialism was also a fan of Spengler. But that's obviously something we could discuss another time. Thank you, Pi, for the £3 donation. Glenn the Chinaman gave $5. Thank you very much. And said, I noticed many Occidental dissidents view race as something as observed by the naked eye. I have seen debate if some Caucasians are white, Chechens, Armenians, etc. Are Caucasians European, or the Caucasus Mountains are in Asia? What do people think about that?
Nicely passed off.
Well, I'm not really even sure what to say about that.
Yeah, I wasn't sure either.
Well, I'm not too sure. Yeah,
it's interesting. It's an interesting question. The Caucasus isn't Europe, okay, and the people there aren't European, but they're sort of our cousins. Let's just put it that way. When you get to Anatolia, when you get to Syria, when you get to Iraq and Iran and the Caucasus, you can go around and you can find people that are phenotypically very white looking, and then their first cousins look like they belong to a different race. It's just a strange place. And I think that these are distinct peoples. We talk about the Middle East and Near East as a distinct sort of sub-racial type. And that's how I look at them. I think that you can describe them as Caucasoid, you know, in a broad sense, like we are. Caucasoid, but non-European. In fact, there's this term, non-European Caucasian. And I think that the people in the Caucasus, the people in Afghanistan, even South Asians, Indians and Pakistanis, they're Caucasoid, but they're non-European. And so I look at groups like the Georgians and the Armenians that way as well. Now, there is this odd fact that in the Caucasus, there are peoples who are Muslim and peoples who are Christian. And the Muslim peoples look towards the East and are hostile to Europe. And the Christians look towards the West and are friendly to Europe. I think that makes them allies, potential allies, people that we would like to be on good terms with. But I think that we can still say that they're not really us. But that's not a problem. Not being us isn't a problem. The only sense in which not being us is a problem is if you're smack dab in the middle of us, right? And we've got to live together all the time. But I think we can have completely congenial relationships with peoples in the Near and Middle East and the Caucasus Mountains and things like that. But I think that we have to recognize that they're not European. They're sort of cousins, though.
Can I ask, what would, if you were to look at a skeleton of these people, how would it fare up against the European? Would you be able to tell the difference?
No, I think that's an interesting question. Probably, yeah. I mean, there are certain differences that would be, there's certainly morphological differences you can see with the skin on, but I imagine that there are morphological differences with the skin off too, things like the shape of the skull and so forth. Again, they're sort of close to us. And this is why it does present an interesting question. But you know, we don't have people don't have to be European for us to get along with them and wish them well.
I agree with that fundamentally, and I'm just going to add to that. One thing that I always found very, very odd about ethno-nationalism, and this is something that's always sort of, I've sort of disliked, really, about ethno-nationalism, is it's always been sort of infested on its fringes with people that are potentially haters, sort of people that regard other races as the enemy, something that I've never really done. I don't believe other races are the enemy. I don't believe they should be here in Britain, but I do believe they have a place in the world. And this is, again, something that made me very uncomfortable with the Tommy Robinson movement. You had lots of people in that movement who, at the mere mention of the potential of war in Iran, they were jumping up and down with excitement because the Muzzies were going to get bombed. And I found that appalling. To me, I don't want to see any harm come to people in Iran or Iraq or Afghanistan or any other people elsewhere in the world, for that matter. Does that mean I want millions of Iranians, Iraqis, Afghans, etc. coming here? No, I don't. My anger has always been with the media, the liberal elite, those in positions of power in the establishment who have conspired to force degeneracy and multiculturalism upon us. But I would always see people of other racial groups who are nationalists for their race and also seek peaceful separation and self-determination as allies. For example, if there was a group of black people living in Britain who said, look, we want the government to give us a certain sum of money and grant us a homeland in Africa, and we're going to run a campaign for all blacks in Britain to return to this African homeland that we need the British government to help us set up, I would share a platform with them, endorse their position, and state unequivocally that should that we ever get to a position of power, we would actually fund that project and help them bring it about. So I don't believe that ethno-national, I believe people who claim to be ethno-nationalists that deal in race hate and deal in sort of a genuine form of it's us and everyone else and the other races are the enemies. I don't believe those people understand ethno-nationalism in the slightest. I think they're the people foisted upon us by the way the media presents us that brings the wrong people to our group.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. There is a place where all different peoples can live together, and that is planet Earth. Doesn't mean, though, that we have to all live in the same polities. We can have our own homelands. The Earth is big enough for every people to have a homeland of its own. And that's the vision that I stand for.
Yeah, agreed.
Right, let's do some of these. Funnily enough, just to cap it off, Yoki seemed to disagree with both of you, and he seemed to be advocating for a European empire, and said that the soul and the spirit of the European man was this desire to stride out and take or capture and impose our will on the rest of the world, basically.
Yeah, he believed that, and I don't agree with that. I think that that's a sort of a dogmatic Nietzscheanism and Spenglerism in his thinking. He also doesn't believe in norms. This is something that's very clear. He believes that weak people have no rights and that small nations have no sovereignty. Norms mean nothing to him. And I completely reject that view. I think norms are absolutely fundamental, and that we need to have a robust understanding of what the right world order is. And the right world order is a world of nation states living in harmony with one another. And the way we get to that world is to recognize the right to national self-determination of all peoples who want that. That is something that he completely rejects. He is a defender of European imperialism against non-whites all over the globe and European imperialism against Europeans within Europe. And I don't agree with that. I think that different peoples should have their own homelands, and that empire is the opposite of nationalism.
I also argue, I'd further what Greg says on this, despite Greg being totally wrong about the Ukraine, I'd agree with him on this and say the following. The British Empire achieved so much power because it was not a racial empire. It was not an empire that sought for white expansionism across the globe. It was an empire that saw relatively small number of whites. So you would have a number of, say, administrators and troops, very small numbers, go to countries that were artificially created on a map. So what you would have is an area of Africa that usually took in at least two ethnic groups. The British Empire would draw some arbitrary boundaries so that at least two ethnic groups were then living in that space. And this small number of troops and administrators would hold sway over the people there because these multiple ethnic groups would be played off against each other in this artificial multicultural state. Sometimes, like in the case of Uganda, other ethnic groups were imported into that artificial multicultural state. So you had like the what were known as the Ugandan Asians to create a new middle class, which caused more racial division. And because of that racial division in this artificial multicultural state, it allowed a very small number of British troops and administrators to effectively govern a large number of people who, if they were homogeneous and one unique people that identified with their own group, they would have easily overthrown the British. So I believe that many of these big empires are not racial in their origin, but are multicultural, as multiculturalism effectively ensures constant conflict between the people being governed, allowing a small force to control vastly disproportionate amounts of space. So yes, I am very, very against that kind of empire. And I think when the left argue that the British Empire was a white supremacist empire, it absolutely wasn't. It didn't see race as an issue, but it used race as a divisive tool, not for the betterment of whites, but for the betterment of a tiny number of the global elite who had positions of power within the British Empire. I don't know if anyone's got any position on what I've just said, or if people think I'm wrong.
No, I agree with that completely. And the same techniques of imperial statecraft that were used by the British to keep the Indian subcontinent under their control with only a few thousand administrators is now being used in your homeland to keep you under control by basically diversifying the country and balkanizing it and making it less and less possible for the native people to come together as a self-conscious group and control their own destiny. So it was the very techniques of imperial statecraft that were in the colonies have now been brought to the homeland. And I think that that is one of the inevitable things that happens with empires, because they don't last forever. And there's always a certain backwash of empire. It always seeps back into the metropole, into the homeland where it started. And then you start realizing, oh, in phase two of the empire, it's not going so well for Britannia anymore. She's not ruling anymore. She's being ruled. And that's inevitable. And this is why I don't like nationalists who want to tout the glories of the British Empire or the French Empire or whatever empire, and then they turn around and complain about the next phase of the empire, which is they're being colonized by their former imperial subjects in their own homelands. That almost always happens with empires.
Well, I'm gonna play devil's advocate and be the exact nationalist you're talking about here, Greg. I'm not sure if I totally believe what I'm about to say, but I'm going to argue on Yockey's behalf in that, firstly, to Mark's point that it was multicultural and wasn't a, in air quotes, white supremacist enterprise, I think it was so plainly apparent at that point what a Englishman was, what a Welsh or Scotsman or an Irishman was, but it didn't have to be, it didn't have to be pointed out in those terms. It was apparent to these guys who turned up in what would have been for the time like a technological marvel, you know, if you can imagine a frigate of the line of the British Empire turning up on the shores of the Congo somewhere or the shores of Africa somewhere to people who, you know, barely understood how to use a sharpened wooden stick, would have it would have been so immediately apparent who was in charge and who deserved to be in charge. To Greg's point, I think that, well, maybe this is just addressing the critique of empire. I think that a nation that strides out like that, even if it's, as we look back on it and say it was terrible, and yes, Greg, you're right in that the collapse of empires leads to this kind of the wave coming back up the beach and ruining things on its way back. To have that in your soul, that spirit of adventure. I mean, the British Empire was guys like us either signing up to go and conquer the world, which is, you know, no small thing to think about. Whether it was, whether you were going to die out there in pain and hardship or contract some horrible disease out in the far-flung reaches of the planet. But it was British guys who were exploring the highest peaks of the world, British guys who were exploring the deepest oceans and the furthest and most unmapped parts of the world. And that is a high responsibility, a great challenge, a great task to take on that inflames the kind of the passions of any man, especially I suspect Europeans. And I think that's what Yoki was arguing for.
Well, I like that. And I do think that there is a spirit of adventure and exploration that we all have. I don't think that needs to necessarily manifest itself in war. You're talking about things like exploration. And I think that that's one of the great outlets for that spirit that we have. Exploration, scientific, artistic development. I would like that drive to go out into the cosmos, right? We've lost that sense of onward and upward, largely because we decided in America that instead of colonizing space, we had to make Black people our equals. And that turned out to be a little too difficult for Faustian man. There are certain things that could not be accomplished, like making them our equals. Again, 100,000 years of evolution in a cold climate might do it, but them programs aren't enough. And we have been deflected from our own mission as a race by trying to basically make the world equal. And I think it's time to get back on that upward trajectory again.
I would argue maybe, again, playing devil's advocate, I would argue that to conquer space, to go beyond the limits of this planet, you would probably need to go some way in conquering and kind of ruling, becoming one of the great world powers. Obviously, it's not possible under the American Empire, I don't think. But I think you would need to go some way into asserting your dominance over a lot of the world's surface before you could consider exploring space. And as you went into space, you would have to do it in an imperialistic fashion as well, I suspect.
Well, fortunately, I don't think there's any life out there. I'd be horrified if there were life out there because I don't think we'd have a chance. I'm kind of comforted by the idea that we might be the only intelligent life in the universe, and then it's ours for the taking. As for commanding resources, things like that, we've learned that it's just cheaper to buy the stuff. I think just pay a fair market price for it and put your blood and energy into making what we need to go out into the universe. We don't have to conquer the Middle East to buy their oil. We don't have to conquer Africa to get their minerals and things like that. And it's actually cheaper just to buy the stuff.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Agreed.
We need to push forward because we've only got 15 minutes left. PKD Dadoos gives £3, thank you so much, and said the Eastern European communist governments were radical atheists. The RSFSR was the first to completely legalize abortion. Countries like Estonia, Czechia and Albania have been badly damaged by this. I didn't know that. I'll have to look that up. And we've got some super chats over on Odyssey as well. Davy Crocco gave $5 and says, hey, what's up? If that's a real Davy Crocco, hello. I'd be interested in speaking to you. You can get hold of me on my Telegram. And 24 Hours gave $5. Thank you so much. He says, this book actually seems really interesting. Where can I get it? The Amazon link is in the description below. The link's always in the description below, my friend. And Glenn19 gave one Odyssey token and said, do you know communism saw itself transformed into ethno-socialism in countries like Poland, China, North Korea and others? North Korea is closer to Japanese fascism than Marxism today. It is preferable to be under communism than liberalism for sure. Yoki is 100% correct. Thank you very much. And Kelt said at the panel, you're doing great for reading a book like this every month. Well done. How do you manage to make the time to read a book? Well, this book was only about maybe 140 pages long. And obviously, if you just read... I haven't actually talked about this, but it's actually a very readable book. So thanks for asking this. I find books like this very easy to actually get through because they're broken down really nicely. And you can do sort of 5-6 pages a day. The books I find difficult to read are monsters with really long chapters. I wouldn't go as far to say this is a toilet book like Jason's book, which is super digestible. But did anyone find this hard to read? I thought it was easy. The sections were easy, but I did find one bit of it a little heavy going, that each section contained so much information and knowledge that often I had to skip back a bit and read sections twice. But I still really enjoyed it. What do you think about the structure of the book quickly before we round up?
I thought I was going to struggle with it when I first started reading. I thought this is going to be a slog. I'm going to be kind of forcing myself to read this. But as it built towards the end, it got easier and easier to read. I think whatever his flaws or whether he was right or wrong, he certainly understood how to put things in a way that was easy to read and then build on the next, his ideas. So he's able to build his ideas. Like I said, the actual thesis of the book is, the title of the book is The Enemy of Europe, and his last essay is titled The Enemy of Europe. I guess maybe I shouldn't say this, but I think it probably be possible to cut out some of the book and just read the final essay or read a few of the final few essays. It wouldn't give you a complete picture of what he wrote, but like you say, it's very digestible. It's very easy to read in chunks like that. So, yeah, like I said, I thought I was going to struggle and I didn't. And it was enjoyable to read.
Yeah, I found it easy to read as well. I think the beginning, you've got I think it's a preface and the introduction, that was the hardest bit. And the rest, I just couldn't put it down. I really couldn't put it. I just sat there for a few hours and just more or less read the whole thing in one go. It's really, really easy to read.
Well, I'm really glad you had that experience. That's good. The credit goes to Yaki primarily because he was a pretty good writer, but I did have a little bit of discretion here because we are translating this back into English from German. And so I tried to make sure that it was as clear and crisp and readable as possible without taking liberties by, say, dividing his sentences up into multiple sentences and things like that. Most of the credit goes to Yaki. I do think he was a fine writer. There's a spirit about his writing that's very youthful and enthusiastic. He did most of his writing when he was in his 30s. He only lived, he was 43 years old, I think, when he died. So most of this is the work of a man in his 20s, early 30s. And there's a passion to it that's, I think, pretty infectious.
I agree with that. Let's give our summations. We'll start with you, Natty, then Aunt Sally, then I'll give mine, and we'll give Greg the final say.
I had a few more points, but I guess we'll have to skip them. I certainly don't agree with everything Yockey's wrote, and some of my notes here were were things that I could challenge the other panelists with. He had a sentence towards the end where he kind of decries nationalism and says no European should be beholden to their state, basically, and all Europeans should be united under this kind of threat of the American Empire. I'm not sure how that would go down with the rest of you guys here, but we'll leave that aside. It's certainly an interesting book. It's very, like I said, it builds towards the end, and the final thesis is certainly interesting, and you can kind of feel his passion and his thoughts and his desires radiating from the book. I recommend it. Yeah, I do recommend it to anyone who is interested in this stuff and interested in the kind of the power play and what was going on in the interwar period and before the war, and how things have shifted and why they may have occurred. There's certainly things in here that I wasn't aware of. For instance, one of the interwar prime ministers of the UK, I can't remember who it was now, I've got it in my notes, essentially said that the British Navy would never sail again or never go to war without America's permission. I think that was in 1936. I may be getting my dates wrong there, but Yockey used this to describe how thoroughly under the boot and how thoroughly subjected the United Kingdom was to America. So there's a lot of interesting stuff in here. I recommend it. And I'm very glad we've all been able to have such a robust discussion about it tonight. So thank you very much, everyone.
Yeah, I agree with what Natty said. I recommend the book. It's a very, very interesting book, and it's been a very interesting stream. I think I'm a bit out of my depth with talk of war. But what I want to say is that there is a reason this book was banned and all but destroyed. And I'm really grateful to people like Greg that bring these books back to life and really do the world a great service there, or our people a great service. Yes, I highly recommend it. And I just want to say as a parting shot that what Greg said about Christianity was that it was subverted right from the beginning. Even the Bible says it will be subverted, and it was. So anyway, get the book, everybody.
I think this is a really interesting book. And I think Yockey was in many ways prophetic, and he makes a very interesting point. And the most interesting thing about this book is when Yockey said what he said, it was a very unpopular opinion in nationalist circles in Europe, and he went against the grain. But here we are in 2022, and undoubtedly he has been proven correct. He has undoubtedly been seen as someone who looked at a situation and said, well, actually, despite the brutality of communism, the people who emerge from it will be better off than the people who are subverted by Judeo-American liberal democracy. And I think that, especially for such a young man, is a remarkable prediction to make. He's not right about everything, and I haven't read Imperium, and what Greg has already said about Imperium sort of somewhat colours me negatively on Yockey, because to suggest that race isn't biological was utterly nonsense. Madness, really. It makes me wonder how he could come to that conclusion. But I think this book is definitely worth buying. And as a nationalist, having this on your shelf is something you should do. You should have this on your shelf. And I don't know what Natty's other notes are, but I did have a number of other notes, which were actually quite specific to a British audience. And I think for a British audience, Yockey basically very, very, I don't know if you agree with this, Natty, but he very, very succinctly breaks down how Britain was once this vast global empire, and it would be reduced to sort of a vassal state of the American liberal imperialist machine. And I think to suggest that in 1953 was also well ahead of its time.
He basically said it was one of the stupidest things in the world. He called it politically stupid, or just idiotic decision to go to war against the wrong enemy. He talks a lot about the way that if you go to war, you should be doing it to gain political power. And there was basically no way that the British Empire could have gained political power either in the First World War by going to war with Germany, or in the Second World War by doing the same thing, because their defeat wouldn't have meant any more power for the United Kingdom or the British Empire. And he's dripping with scorn for Churchill as well, if that makes any difference to anyone.
That made me enjoy the book a lot more.
I thought it might do.
I do think his analysis of the interwar period is filled with interesting insights. And yeah, if you are interested in politics, especially Anglo-American politics in the interwar period, I think his analysis is very rich and interesting. I learned a lot from that too, definitely. I'm glad you like this book. I think it's obviously a book that provokes a lot of thought and discussion. We've shown that in nearly 2 hours of discussion. And I'm sure there are people out in the audience who are gritting their teeth and they're angry because, well, they've been stirred up and they haven't been satisfied yet. But no, you know, a book that can stir up thought is worth it. That's a high compliment to say that a book has stirred up thought and some anger here. And maybe his outlook isn't fully adequate. The more I read Yaki, the less I agree with him, to be perfectly honest. But it's interesting to me, and it's been a growth experience to me, to figure out why and where I disagree with Yaki on certain points. So I think he's a great enemy, if you will, or a great adversary in some ways to sharpen my wits on. And I think he deserves to be read. He deserves to be preserved, which is why I've undertaken a huge amount of work on this edition. There's only 3 volumes in it because, well, he didn't live all that long and a lot of his writings were destroyed or lost after his death. But again, what he did write and what we do have is definitely worth reading and thinking about. And I want the nationalist right to be an exciting intellectual movement. And this is red meat for that. Whether you agree with it or disagree with it, Yaki's theses in books like Imperium or The Enemy of Europe are extremely provocative and extremely interesting, food for thought. And I think that that nourishes us as an intellectual movement, an intellectual scene. And really, the people on the right today are the only people who have an exciting intellectual scene, I think. The left is just dead. They're all just paranoid about committing some new sin. They don't think at all.
Or just openly statists in the case of someone like Vauch or...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, these people are boring. These people are extremely boring. They're not intellectually interesting. And I think the right is. Yaki's one of these fixtures of a vital intellectual right. So I'm glad you all like this book. I urge people out there to pick it up and enjoy it. And I look forward to coming back next year and we can talk about our new edition of Imperium, maybe.
I would very much like that. I always enjoy when we have Greg on. I think it's been a great show tonight. It's actually been one of our highest viewed book clubs. I've just heard from Sven, 1,483 people watched it over on Radio Albion or listened in, and we've had about 200 people on Odyssey and DLive. So this has obviously piqued people's interest. So thank you to everyone.